Well, I'm glad you stuck with me after that last session. A little bit of humbling there, and hopefully you've had a chance to be with God enough so that you can sense that dark side, where it is in you, and start building the defenses against it. That's really what I want to talk about today. You'll notice the title of this session is Overcoming the Dark Side. You see, you won't be able to accomplish your calling as a leader if the dark side wins out. Now, thank God, I didn't say this last time, and I should say it again. If there's anything about God that we know is that He's a God of grace, and He's a God of goodness, and He wants good for you. He wants good for me. And so we find people in Scripture who failed and gave in to the dark side at various times, and yet God continued to use them. You got Moses, who was a murderer. He murdered the Egyptian in cold blood. You've got David, who is an adulterer, and yet he's restored to kingship. And he's held up as a model of what it means to be a king. These kind of people, Abraham lying about his sister, or his wife, saying, you know, she's my sister. All those kind of people in Scripture are flawed human beings, because every human being is flawed. And yet God, through His grace, continued to love them, continued to use them as leaders in His kingdom. And so, whatever your dark side situation, you know that God can continue to use you. But what I want to talk about in this session is just some keys or steps, and not really steps, but some keys to overcoming it. How do you overcome that dark side? What do you do about it? Well, the first thing to do about it, I guess, is acknowledge that you have one. Denial is a very important part of who we are in our dark side. We can push it away. We can pretend it's not there. And what happens then is we get into this pretending mode, and that pretending mode can even infect churches. One of the most impactful books that I've read in my life is by a man named John Fisher. He was a musician back in the 70s, became a church leader and author of several different books. But he wrote a book called 12 Steps for the Recovering Pharisee, and then in parentheses, Like Me. And in that introduction, he says, you know, the church is full of Pharisees. And what he says by that, he says, you know, it's the only organization that if you want to become part of the church, you have to admit that you're a sinner. I am a sinner. I have failed to live the way God has directed me to live. You've got to admit that to become part of the church. He says, but if you are part of the typical church in the United States, at least, once you make that step and you admit that and you say, I've received Jesus Christ's forgiveness for my sins, you go into this pretend mode that you never sin again. So much so, he says in the book, says that when sin does crop up in a church, when somebody is acknowledged to have done a public sin, that all people are aghast. Like, how horrible can this be? And so he says, step number one in the 12 steps of overcoming the Pharisee in us, he says, is to acknowledge that we like to judge people. You know, we like to judge people. If we can judge people, or put people below us in some sense, then we can feel better about ourselves. And as a result, we get into this denial thing of, well, we wouldn't do that. We're not like that. And so the first step of overcoming the dark side in your life is acknowledging that you have it. Maybe even defining where it is and where it manifests itself in you. You know, are you somebody who is addicted to drugs? How did that begin? Are you somebody who's hooked on pornography? Are you willing to admit that to yourself, beginning to God? Certainly, He already knows all of that. Where does your dark side manifest itself? Are you greedy? Are you a liar? You know that you tend to take stories and blow them up even bigger when they make you look good, and then tread on that line of what's truth or what's untruth. Where is your dark side? Acknowledge that you have one. Then honestly examine your past. Your family of origin has a lot to do with how you developed your dark side. Again, we all have one, but your family of origin can contribute to making it worse, or sometimes making it better by God's grace. Last time, I showed you the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And so where in that area did you lack something? Was it in the physiological? You know, some people who are very, very successful in our world today were made so because they became driven people for the wrong reasons. They were poor, and they resolved that they were not going to live that way as an adult. And so they are driving themselves, even become workaholics, because they don't want to ever go back to that point. It's a hole in their life at the physiological level. Many years ago, at the advice of a counselor, I read a book called We Are Driven. And there's three reasons why somebody is driven to succeed in life, at least materially. And number one is that you lived in poverty, or you lived a deprived life, and so you decided you're driven not to have that again. Another driven type is where you had very successful parents. And as a result, you're always trying to live up to that expectation, or you're trying to exceed what they did, and so you become driven. Or that there was a special need within the family, like a sick person that was somebody that the whole family had to kind of rally around, and that became an identity that can create a driven person. Where are those things that drive you in this pyramid? Like you say, you could be driven to material success because of a physiological situation. You could be driven to material success because of security. If something's missing in that area of love and belonging, where you know that you have been unconditionally loved and then launched into the world as somebody who's been unconditionally loved, that's going to leave a gap in you. And you're going to seek to fulfill that gap or will be tempted to fulfill that gap in inappropriate ways. So is there a gap there for you? What about the self-esteem? Have you experienced some level of success in your life? And as you've been launched as a student, were your works as a student praised when you did something well? Or was it always criticism that was given you? When you did something in your home, was it praise that you received? Or was it always criticism? Was it always the cut down? Is that an area where you are lacking? Or is in the self actualization area that you've tried things and you failed and you failed and you failed and you failed. You've been fired from jobs and as a result you're just that acceptance of others and respect of others is lacking. So where is it? Where in this? Examine your past. Look at your past honestly and try to identify where those holes are. Now, you may need the help of a counselor to do that well. I thank God for a couple of them in my life, men who were able to help me look at myself in ways I'd never looked at myself before and understand how I became who I became as I sought to understand what had happened to me and also, you know, build into my life appropriate ways of experiencing acceptance. And so I thank God for men today who are in my life who provide some of those areas where I've got a gap, a hole, and they are able to help me see that and help me fill that because I know that I am loved by these men. They tell me that, and they tell me that regularly. So where is it for you? If you need a counselor, get one. It will be well worth the investment you make in that regard. And, you know, many churches have a practice, or many organizations have a practice where they will help pay for that. And so I just want to encourage that, but take an honest look at your past and how it may have affected you. Resist the poison of unrealistic expectations. Now, you know, studies of clergy in the United States have indicated that many of us are people pleasers. I'm not the only one. Many of us need the approval of people, and so we go into ministry for approval. And then we find that the expectations are just huge, and we begin to realize we can't meet them. I'm reading from a survey that was recently done, an extensive survey of pastors in the United States. 72% of pastors in the United States report working between 55 to 75 hours per week. Can you imagine? 84% of pastors feel they are on call 24/7. 65% of pastors feel their family lives in a glass house and fear they are not good enough to meet other people's expectations. 65%. 78% of pastors report having their vacation and personal time interrupted with ministry duties or expectations. In other words, you're on vacation and you get the call that somebody in the church died and you've got to come home right away. 65% of pastors feel they have not taken enough vacation time with their family over the last 5 years. You know, you can't go away because you're so needed. You can't take that break. 28% of pastors report having feelings of guilt for taking personal time off and not telling the church. 35% of pastors report the demands of church denies them from spending time with their family. 66% of church members expect a minister and family to live at a higher moral standard than themselves. That's always a fascinating one as far as expectations. 75% of pastors report significant stress-related crises at least once in their ministry. 52% of pastors feel overworked and cannot meet their church's unrealistic expectations. 54% of pastors find the role of pastor overwhelming. 35% of pastors battle depression or fear of inadequacy. 81% of pastors have been tempted to have inappropriate sexual thoughts or behavior with someone in the church but have resisted. And And here's just a couple more. 30% of churches have no documentation clearly outlining what the church expects of the pastor. And so it's anybody who wants you, it's a legitimate request. And then the last one, 1 out of every 10 pastors will actually retire as a pastor in the United States. 1 out of 10. And I see that in my graduating class from seminary many years ago. People are dropping out of ministry, and those kind of stresses are the reasons why. And so we have to resist the poison of unrealistic expectations. We have to realize that everybody else's crisis doesn't have to be ours. You know, I had to learn that just because somebody called me and their family was in an uproar over this, that, or another thing, doesn't mean that that was my crisis, that I had to leave what my family was doing at that time. It meant that I had to practice carefully and faithfully. What Peter Wagner said once was a daily diversion. I've got to be diverted from my responsibilities daily. A weekly withdrawal, that there are time I spend away, and then an annual abandonment, where I spend enough time away that I get away from ministry enough to be renewed and refreshed. How do you do this? Well, this passage has become one of my favorites. Paul is writing here to Corinth. Now, if you know the background to Paul's letter to the two letters to the Corinthians, you know that he did not have the greatest relationship with the people in Corinth. He started the church there. Things were going great. And then people began to criticize him as not an apostle. Others came in, said they should be following a different path than what Paul had set out for them. And he writes defending himself, but this passage here is one that catches my attention when it comes to unrealistic expectation. He says, "This then is how you ought to regard us. First, as servants of Christ." Now, it's a good image to have for yourself. In fact, the word servant here is an interesting one. In the original language of the New Testament, the language of Greek, there are different words that can be translated as servant into English. The most common one is doulos, which describes somebody who's like a slave in your house. This one is a little different than that. It's only used one other time in the New Testament, and there it's used in the book of Acts. When Paul and Barnabas take off on their missionary journey, they take John Mark, a relative of Barnabas, along. And it says that John Mark is this person. Now, it's not often translated in Acts as servant, but he's a servant to them. In other words, he's there to take care of, making sure lodging at the next city is taken care of. He's making sure that the boat tickets are in place. He was taking care of the details to serve Paul and Barnabas. The picture that helps me in this is the basic meaning of the word. It can mean under rower. Now, in order to understand that, you have to get in your mind the picture of a ship back then, maybe a ship that was ready to go to war, right? And you remember that they've got these various levels, but the bottom level of the ship is this set of oars that go to row the ship. And if you went down into that, if you've seen movies about it, like Ben-Hur and that sort of thing, if you go down into the bowels of the ship, here are these different people, usually slaves, who have an oar that they hold, and they are responsible for pulling on that oar. And they don't decide whether they're going to, do a turn, or they're going this direction or that direction. That's made higher than them. That's made by the captain of the ship. They don't decide when they have to go fast or when they have to go slow. They are the ones who are obeying orders or following the leadership of those above them. Well, it's that kind of picture that's in this word of being an under rower. That my role in the leadership that God has given me is that I am an under rower. I'm not God. I'm the one who's down there taking my oar and rowing. And so I understand that this is my responsibility. And I ask other people to regard me that way. Now, what this means is I can't compare myself to somebody else. You know, that's a great thing in among ministries and ministers and clergy and church staff and people who lead various nonprofit organizations and even in corporations. There'll be this comparison thing that happens when people meet. And the comparison is kind of like establishing a pecking order. You know, if you put 10 chickens together in a pen, pretty soon they'll have a pecking order by pecking each other to decide who's on the top here and who's next and who's next and who's next and who's next and who's on the bottom, the person who gets pecked, the chicken that gets pecked by everybody. Well, there's something like that happens in public meetings where people start comparing each other and say, you know what? Well, you know, how big is your church? How many people are attending? You know, what's your budget? How much money do you deal with? Those kind of things of compare. Well, I can't compare myself to anybody else because I've got my oar. That's the one that I am pulling. Somebody else is got a different oar. And my job is not to say, oh, my oar is more important than yours, because it's all under the leadership of the captain. And so I have to get this image of myself that says, when it comes to people's expectation, that I'm doing the oaring, the rowing that I have to do. And I've got to define that. What is calling, my mission. That's why I had you look at your mission a couple of sessions ago. So first of all, we are to look at ourselves as servants, as the under rower of Jesus Christ, and as those entrusted with the mysteries God has revealed. Now, mysteries is a wonderful word in English. It draws to mind a mystery novels. I love to read mystery novels. One of my favorites years ago was Agatha Christie. And you know, a murder on the River Nile or the Orient Express. What happens in chapter one is a group of people are on this train or on this boat, and one of them is dead at the end of chapter one. And you think you know who it is because there have been a few clues, but then at the end of chapter two, the person you thought who did the murder is murdered themselves. And so eventually there are a group of clues that build until finally the mystery is revealed at the end of who the murderer was. Well, that's one way to think of mystery. And then you would say, well, you know, Paul's dealing out these little facts so that someday, hopefully, they'll come to understanding. Well, that's not what's going on, is what he's talking about here, as far as how you view yourself. You're a steward of the mysteries. This is more like a lodge. You know, my understanding, I'm not a Mason, but my understanding is that Masons have secrets. And you don't know those secrets. Those of us who are outside are not given insight into those secrets until you join. And once you've joined and you've made the commitment, then you are given all the secrets. Well, that's the way Paul is using it here. He says, I'm a servant, but I've been entrusted with this great mystery. He defines it elsewhere as that God building a church and building it amazingly with Jews and Gentiles together. And this incredible story of grace, that it's not how you perform that makes God loves you, but it's simply the gift of His grace and His mercy to you that create His love in you. That's an incredible mystery. And he says, now it's required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. In other words, he's seeking to prove faithful as he rows, as he's a steward of this mystery. He's been given this message to give out to other people, and he's been given this charge to build churches various places. But then he says, I care very little if I'm judged by you or by any human court. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. That's where I think we've got to try to strive for, that we don't judge ourselves by other people's expectations, and we don't always try to meet those expectations. That we have to determine which expectations are legitimate and which aren't. I can't solve everybody's problem, especially as a church grows or a ministry grows or an organization grows. You as a leader are going to be able to solve fewer and fewer problems. And eventually you'll just wear out. Find that with Moses, right? We looked at Moses as a leader way back early on in this series of classes. And that wonderful time with Jethro, his father-in-law, comes along and says, you know, you're not doing good. Moses was listening to every case, every complaint, every problem, said, you've got to divide this up and ship it out to other people. And Moses created a wonderful organization that allowed the people to move forward effectively toward the promised land. So you've got to fight this unrealistic expectations. Resist the poison of it. It's going to come after you, especially if you're a people pleaser. Resist it. Fourthly, develop spiritual disciplines in your life. Prayer is important. A prayer can be a real weakness for pastors, interestingly enough. In a study that was done of pastors several years ago now, they found that pastors pray on the average 7 minutes per day. You know, we're so busy, right? And we get up in the morning and we're running and we get a telephone call in the middle of the night. We're just sometimes too busy to pray and too busy to take the time out to connect with the captain, the one who's our leader, the one who's the shepherd whom we shepherds follow. Prayer is an important discipline to develop. Bible study, important discipline, not so you can make sermons, but so that you can hear yourself. I developed in one stage of my life in trying to increase my spiritual disciplines, I developed identified several preachers that I liked to listen to because they were so much unlike me. I wasn't going to use their stuff in sermons. But I would listen to them because it would feed my soul. And so I would spend time in silence and solitude. That's another spiritual discipline. I'd spend a day where I would go out to the monastery right near where I live here, and I'd spend a morning or a day just alone, just spending time with God. And part of that day I would set aside just to listen to a message or two and reflect on what it means for me. Recently I had the wonderful gift of spending a week by myself, just spending the days out hiking in the woods, walking by the river, just spending time letting my soul be restored. Spiritual disciplines. Now there are others. Journaling, meditation. Spending time to actually think through things under God's guidance and learning what Christian meditation is. It's gotten a bad rap because of Eastern religions and their form of meditation. But meditation is a scriptural principle. We read about Isaac in the Old Testament in the book of Genesis that he went out to the field in the evening to meditate, to think through things, to think through his relationship with God. The more of these that you practice, the more effective you're going to be in overcoming the dark side. Now, silence and solitude, I have one man who is my accountability partner, and he knows every weak part of my soul. I share with him almost everything. He is my spiritual partner. And that's another step, to have one or two, maybe three people with whom you are honest, maybe a group of people. Some people are doing it in accountability groups now where they come together and they share and they pray for each other. But he's my partner. I was talking to him at one point about silence and solitude because that's a difficult thing for me. I tend to be more on the extroverted side of the scale, as I shared before, and so I like to be around people. And I process things verbally, and so I like to talk with people. And so to spend time in silence and solitude can be a challenge for me. But my good friend, one time as we were talking about his discipline in that, was saying, you know, he said, every good idea I've had over the last 10 years, and he's a powerful leader, said came out of a time of silence and solitude where he took one day per month just to go out and spend 6 to 8 hours walking with the Bible, with maybe a good book to read, but that he was withdrawing from the tension and the stress of his job in the world in order to listen to God again. So disciplines, but partners. Book of James says that, right? Chapter 5, confess your sins to one another that you may be healed. You know, we can become the spiritual Pharisees in your church and in mine, where we believe or pretend that nobody has problems with sin. And there's something about sharing it, taking it out of the darkness and bringing it to the light with somebody else, that takes away the power of sin. And so developing some spiritual partners, people with whom you can share yourself, share the things you are struggling with, people with whom you develop a trust level to know that they're going to love you and they're going to help fill some of those need things in your life. But you can tell them anything, and that you can have them praying for you about areas where you want to be held accountable, that you can identify areas where you want to be held accountable. Yeah. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it took people bonding together. The founders of Alcoholics Anonymous recognized that reality, that on their own they weren't able to conquer this thing in their life. But when they together bonded to each other, helped each other, were available to each other in a moment of need, miraculous things happened as far as their recovery, and they began to share that. Now it's spread all over the world. It all begins with this idea. There are some people who are for you. They're in your corner. You can share with them, and you know that they will receive you. They won't judge you, but will continue to hold you accountable where you need to be held accountable, and will encourage you in the good things. So, spiritual partners, an important part of overcoming the dark side. And then aim in your life for humility, transparency, truth-telling. Humility, first of all. When people want to praise you, to be able to say, hey, you know, to God be the glory. Pedestals are tough for church leaders in the world, because the bigger the pedestal, the higher people put you. And people will want to put you on a pedestal because we have a need for heroes somehow in our world. And we do that with movie stars, we do it with musicians, and we do it with church leaders too. We put them on these huge pedestals as if they are better than we are, that they don't have a dark side, that they are these marvelous, effective people. And, you know, I know from some experience that falling off a pedestal is very painful and very difficult. And so one of the things I'm aiming for in my life is a humility that acknowledges that, you know, I'm a sinner saved by grace. I am somebody who is nobody without Jesus Christ in my life. Transparency. I don't hide that I'm a sinner anymore. I'm willing to tell you part of my story. Just because I, apart from the grace of God, I'm nothing. And to get to transparency, to be able to tell some people, to be open to people, to not let them put you on the pedestal, and tell the truth to other people and yourself. Yeah, dark side is a tough thing. This closing passage from 1 Corinthians 10. Paul is talking about temptation, obviously. He says, so if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, He will also provide a way out so that you can endure it. The center of that passage is when you are tempted, He's going to provide the way out. Now, you have to take the way, and you can build in your life marvelous protections that allow you to go on and serve God powerfully, even if you've failed. It takes time to restore trust in people. It takes time to restore the levels of leadership that people will allow you to take, and authority will allow you to take. There will be setbacks at times. But overall, as you conquer the dark side, you'll become a much more effective leader. A friend of mine is an alcoholic, and was that for many years. He came to Christ because he was, one day in a snowstorm, his car died. And he was homeless at the time. His wife had kicked him out. He had nothing. And he ended up walking in the snow to a little tiny town that was just off the freeway where his car had broken down. And he ended up at the post office, knocked on the door. And a woman came out and said, boy, you look terrible. And he said, well, I need to call somebody to get my car. He was trying to get to a mission in a nearby town. And this woman said, you know, I think you need this. And gave him a little book that was just the promises of God. And that started him on a path toward conquering alcoholism. As he says, it's never conquered. It's there every day, but he faces it every day. And he has become a leader in the church and in the business world where he's thriving. It can happen. It can happen that we become people who don't pretend anymore, but are willing to call God's people to transparency with each other, and so that we're not Pharisees, but we're all growing together as people who are all broken somewhere. Somewhere we're all broken. But by God's grace, he's taking us, and he's instating us in places where the kingdom can grow and needs our gifts and our learning and our ability. And so I want to encourage you. I want to encourage you. As we're going to be moving on now to culture, I want to encourage you to get connected to your dark side in a way that you understand it and you put these kind of things into practice so that it doesn't do you in. There's a principle in warfare, as long back as the Civil War, it became obvious, but it was noticed before that. And that is, if you're going to be an effective a battler, what you should do when you've got your army over here and their army is over here is you don't just shoot indiscriminately. You're trying to shoot at the leaders, the officers on the other side. In the Civil War in the United States, that became very obvious. And so officers often, you know, will ride back and forth on horses, and it just became target practice for some of these people on the other side. Because, you know, they knew that if you could shoot the officers, the leaders, you would have a greater impact that would lead to victory, because these people then, the soldiers, the general run-of-the-mill soldier, would be leaderless, so they wouldn't know where they were going or how they would get there, and as a result, you had a greater chance of victory. Well, know that the enemy desires to take down leaders because it will have a greater impact for victory for his side. And so, I'm calling you in the name of Jesus Christ to know him well, and to know yourself well, so that you are victorious, and the glory will be to God one day for what he does in you and through you.